Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission explains why he now calls nuclear energy a failed technology that will lead to catastrophic events. Gregory B. Yatsko was head of the agency in 2011 when an earthquake triggered a failure at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan, and he traveled there to assist in the disaster response. The accident helped convince Yatsko that the risks of nuclear energy are greater than the benefits, even if safety failures are few and far between. Our conversation starts after a short break. Nuclear energy isn't safe. The guy who used to run the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for one. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Gregory B. Yatsko was a commissioner at the agency for 4 years before being named chairman in 2009. Unlike many of the people who've held those jobs over the years, Yatsko didn't arrive at the commission with close professional ties to the nuclear energy industry. He describes himself as a nuclear power moderate when he started at the Regulatory Commission, although he'd worked for then-Senator Harry Reid coordinating resistance to the Yucca Mountain Waste Repository in Nevada. In any case, Yatsko's time running the Nuclear Regulatory Commission convinced him. Nuclear energy is too dangerous to mess with, and if we do decide to keep using it, we should think about disasters not in terms of if, but when. His book is called Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Greg, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So you took a really roundabout path to this work. Do most people who serve on or chair the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have a background with the nuclear energy industry?
You know, they have a number of different backgrounds, but usually they have some relationship with the industry or the ancillary industries, engineering schools, legal law firms that specialize in representing nuclear clients. And those are some of the past jobs of some of the more recent chairs. You also had in the past, you've had some folks who have come from the Navy, the nuclear programs that are in the U.S. Navy, and that had been a feeder for a while. But usually they're working in some kind of industry that has a direct tie. So usually either the academic nuclear engineering programs or the legal profession.
How is the commission kept politically balanced, at least theoretically politically balanced?
Well, there's a law that says that the composition of the commission has to be about no more than three people from one political party. There's five commissioners altogether on the commission, and that's how the balance is supposed to be maintained. But there's not really a direct alignment between a political party and your views about nuclear power. In fact, you know, for the most part, there's kind of a large block of both Republicans and Democrats in Washington who are supportive of nuclear power. So, you know, it tends to manifest itself on the commission then that you have really a majority of the commissioners are pretty much always supportive of the industry, at least in, you know, some of the more recent incarnations of the commission.
So how did you end up in Washington?
So I started my career as a scientist. I was working in a very esoteric field of physics, of particle physics, to be exact, and was working on a PhD program in Madison, Wisconsin. And as I was doing that, I started to realize that while I loved physics and had loved physics and science since I was a kid, when I started to think about being a scientist, I realized that wasn't what I wanted to do, that I really wanted to do something where I could do more practical kind of work that had a more immediate impact on society and dealing with problems and challenges of society. And so many of those involve science and technology issues that I thought it'd be great if there's a way I could kind of jump into the policy arena. And I was very fortunate to get a fellowship that was designed exactly for that, which was to take scientists and transition them out of science and give them a year in Washington and, you know, kind of see how they do, throw them into the deep end and see whether they sink or swim. And I was very fortunate to work for a congressman from Massachusetts and during that fellowship year. And after that, I then went, as you said in the beginning, to work for Senator Harry Reid from Nevada, working on the Yucca Mountain Project, which was a planned nuclear waste storage dump in the state of Nevada, which he represented. And so that kind of moved me from being a physicist to a political staffer to then eventually getting onto the commission.
You said before you were nominated to serve on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you hadn't formed your views, your opinions, I guess, on nuclear power. How important was it to you that you came to a conclusion about whether nuclear energy was good or bad or somewhere in between?
You know, that was something I had always tried to avoid doing because I felt like, especially when I was on the NRC, my job was to be as dispassionate as I could about nuclear technology, about the plants that we regulated, because my job was to protect public health and safety. And the less I thought about whether I thought nuclear was good or bad, the more I felt like I could make those decisions with that focus exclusively on public health and safety. And so, you know, I really never thought about it in a way. I mean, it was just part of what I did. I dealt with the technology and I knew the good things about it. I knew the bad things about it. But once I experienced the Fukushima accident in Japan and really the reaction of the industry, the reaction of the technology in a way to this incident, I started to really have to confront some facts that I really couldn't reconcile with just not taking a position on. That at that point, I really began to realize that, you know, I do have a view about this technology. And that view was that it's a technology that has a lot of problems and is not going to be a long-term solution for our energy needs. And that's especially important right now, I think, because so many people are talking about climate change, which, as much as I have concerns about nuclear power, I think climate change is an even bigger problem. And so many people are talking about nuclear power as really this kind of savior for climate change. And based on the industry that I know, because of cost issues, because of management issues, because of accidents, it's simply never going to meet that challenge. And so we need to start recognizing that now so that we don't go down this path and then wind up with a failed solution. And not only will we have problems with nuclear, but then we'll have problems with the climate that we've failed to solve in the right way earlier.
Who gets to decide in the United States how safe is safe enough when it comes to nuclear?
You know, that is by law the decision of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And Congress, in their infinite wisdom, created a very opaque standard for what safety means. And they have the law that created the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says essentially that you decide that nuclear is safe if it meets a reasonable assurance of adequate protection. So some kind of a jumble of words that Congress wrote so that it would leave it up to the NRC to figure out what that means. And that's in essence then what the NRC does is it's trying to take those words and put it into very practical, specific regulations that would establish what it meant to achieve that adequate protection. And, you know, at least on paper, that's the way it's supposed to work. But in practice, like almost all policy, it's heavily influenced by the industries that regulate it, by Congress, by the president, by whoever has a role in shaping the body that ultimately does the regulation.
So you ultimately served as chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Before that, you were a commissioner. Can you explain the work that commissioners do and how you interacted with the sort of full-time permanent staffers at the agency?
Yeah, so the commission as a whole, the body, the five-person body, sets the policy. So, you know, in essence, it's up to the commission to make that decision about, you know, what safety really means. And that involves, obviously, the very interacting frequently with the very experienced technical staff that make up the bulk of the agency. At the time I was chairman, there were almost 4,000 individuals that worked at the NRC. And so, you know, you interact with them, you get briefing materials, you have briefings, meetings, all kinds of opportunities to try and get information from them to help formulate, you know, the decisions that the commission has to make about really what safety is. And it's a very it's a very complicated process. There's no simple answer to a lot of these questions of when a nuclear power plant meets that legal standard and when it doesn't.
You have mostly very good things to say about the permanent non-political staffers at the agency. Talk about the kinds of work that they do to monitor what's happening at these plants, to sort of keep tabs on how closely the industry is actually following the rules.
Yes, so there's a whole number of different types of employees at the agency dealing with nuclear power plants. You have at the plants themselves, you have at least two what we refer to as resident inspectors. And these are people whose job it is to be at the plants essentially every day and do inspection activities, interact with the plant operators, and really just get firsthand knowledge of what's going on at the plant. And now, you know, they can do a lot, but they can only do so much because, you know, a typical nuclear power plant will have hundreds of employees, hundreds of workers. They're very complicated machines. So the two NRC people that are at the site can get some information, but they can't get all the information. So, you know, that's in a way, that's the most direct eyes and ears that the agency has at a plant. Then you have, there are regional offices. There are actually four regional offices in the country for the NRC, one actually in Texas. And there you have additional employees. You have inspectors who maybe specialize in very specific areas like electrical engineering or structural engineering, who go out then to plants various times during the year, and they inspect certain aspects of the performance. Whether it's, you know, if you're an electrical engineer, you'll look at electrical components. If it's structural, you'll look at the main structural components of the reactor. So you've got people like that. And then you have a whole different group of people who are technical analysts, who are licensing professionals. So their job is to look at the plants. And sometimes plants need changes to their operating license. So that's the permit that allows them to operate. And there are changes that need to be done with those licenses. And so they'll review those changes and make recommendations. And then you have a whole nother group of people who do the general policy. So they're not necessarily working directly on a nuclear power plant safety, but they're looking at the general policies and rules that govern how the plants operate. So there's many, many different people. More than half the agency at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are professionals who focus on the nuclear power plant sector.
So with regard to licensing of new plants that are planned and that will come online, help us understand this. You explained that, you know, it's not an easy thing to get a license, but once a company has a license to operate a nuclear power facility, they have a considerable amount of latitude with regard to how they're going to implement the rules set forth by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Yeah, it's really, I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or really any kind of safety regulator in general. You don't have this infinite authority to just do things all the time. You have to work within a legal framework. And any decisions you take have to be really justified, and they have to recognize the fact that you have granted this license, and with that license comes, you know, the authority for somebody to do something, in this case to operate a nuclear power plant. So whenever you're going to really impinge upon that, you have to have a really, really good basis. And of course, you know, the subtext to all of that is among the power plant operators is that they can always sue you. They can challenge those decisions in court. So, you know, there is this natural give and take that goes on sometimes that, you know, I think it can be destructive to the process, but it's a fact of life that you just, you know, once they have a license, they have a lot of authority. And, you know, one of the subtle distinctions about the way nuclear power plants are regulated, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, there's really two classes of safety standards. There's those things which are, you know, meet this esoteric term that I used in the beginning about adequate protection or reasonable assurance of adequate protection. And those standards, the agency can impose without considering the cost of the regulations. But then there's other things that are standards that are good to have, things that are that would make plants safer, but maybe don't quite go as strong as this fundamental standard. And when you're looking at those kinds of changes, then the agency has to justify the cost. And that can always be a very challenging and difficult thing to do because, you know, costs are real. They, you know, the power plant can come and tell you if you're going to implement a regulation exactly how much it's going to cost them. Figuring out what the benefit is a little bit more difficult because usually the benefit is avoiding some type of accident, some type of bad scenario. And those things, while they can be very catastrophic, don't happen all that often.
So, Mike, I have to take a break here. Hang on one second. Let me just interrupt you. My guest is Gregory B. Yatsko, former commissioner and chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory B. Yatsko. His new book is called Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Greg, you were saying if the Nuclear Regulatory Commission comes up with new safety standards, the people who run nuclear power facilities can hand you a very precise list of how much that's going to cost them and what that will do to their ability to make money.
Yeah, and to be able to challenge that or to impose the regulation, you need to be able to show a benefit that's equal to that or greater than that. And that benefit is a little bit harder to calculate because it's based on preventing a hypothetical accident. And you know, that was a lot of how I saw and viewed nuclear power when I really first started on the commission and as I started my tenure as chairman. But one of the things that fundamentally changed was when I learned and realized that these accidents actually weren't just hypothetical calculations. They were real. Hmm. And that real accident was a very catastrophic accident in Japan that I had a very strong involvement with for a lot of my time as chairman.
Yeah. So like when Chernobyl happened, I think a lot of Americans were alarmed, but it also seemed like the United States had to be better prepared, right, to prevent or at least respond to that kind of disaster. That case is harder to make when we consider a wealthy, industrialized democracy like Japan really descending into chaos with a nuclear accident.
Yeah, the Chernobyl accident had happened in the 1980s. It happened in the Soviet Union. Information was very, very limited. I mean, it was about 6 months after the accident before really any information came to the U.S. or to other countries in Europe about what really happened. So you had this accident. It was mysterious. It was something that was far away and very remote and in a lot of ways could be blamed on the Soviet Union and the infrastructure there that was also somewhat opaque and not clear to everyone. And the incident in Japan, though, as you said, was very, very different because here it was a country, was an advanced industrialized nation using technology that was ultimately derived from the United States technology. So it's a very, very different scenario. And you know, I saw firsthand how they were struggling to process this. And you know, one of the things that I saw were the faces of the people at the NRC who were helping to try and make sense of what was going on and assist the Japanese. And there was just this look of surprise and disappointment in a way that, you know, we thought we had put these kinds of things behind us, that these kinds of accidents simply weren't going to happen anymore. And now all of a sudden we're in the middle of one. And it's far worse than anything that we had ever experienced in the United States and was really almost on par with what happened at Chernobyl. So very, very shocking to the system, really, and really shocking to regulators all over the world because we had come to this, you know, we'd built this idea that we were doing everything right for safety and that accidents were a thing of the past, and they just weren't.
Can you walk us through a layperson's explanation of exactly what went wrong at Fukushima?
Sure. And it's a really, I mean, nuclear power plants are very interesting. And it's why I was always very intrigued by the technology when I came to the agency, because I was a scientist and there's a lot of science in here. But the simplest way to think about it is that there's an engine, the nuclear engine, and that's really what generates heat. And that heat you then use to generate steam, and steam can turn a turbine, which generates electricity. So that's the basic way that things work. But the difference with a nuclear power plant is that when you turn that engine off, you know, imagine you turn the key off and the engine stops. The way the nuclear reactor works is there's still a lot of heat and a lot of energy left over even once you kind of turn the engine off. And so every nuclear power plant has a whole system of pumps, of pipes, of water, of motors, and all kinds of different components that help take that heat away, that help remove all that heat. Because if you don't get rid of that heat, it is enough energy that you can take water, which is part of this cooling process, you can boil that water, and then you can create all kinds of havoc with the reactor. And so that's what happened at Fukushima, is that the systems that are there to remove all of that heat were disabled, and they were disabled in two primary ways. One, there was a catastrophic magnitude 9 earthquake just off the coast of Japan. So that system, that earthquake, took out a lot of the power supplies that go into the plant that make all of these different systems work. And then after that earthquake, you had an even more devastating for the plant and actually for the community around the plant as well, a devastating tsunami, tremendously high, something around 50 feet high tsunami that slammed into the reactor. And that took out the systems that are there to ensure that you have power and electricity when the main electricity systems are lost. And so you got into what's called a station blackout. Hmm. And it's exactly what it sounds like. You don't have any more power. The operators were literally in the control room without lights. They had no instruments. They had no idea what was happening with the reactors. And once that happens, this heat and this energy that you have in the reactor, even though it's shut off, is enough to create this catastrophic release of radiation.
Let me stop you for just a second, because people might be listening to this and saying, wait a second, a plant that generates electricity doesn't have electricity after an earthquake. This is something that I learned from your book that I did not understand. Most nuclear power plants don't actually use any of the electricity that they are creating.
Yeah, it is a somewhat of it appears inconsistent in a way that here you are generating this electricity. But the reason is that you need these systems to operate even when the reactor is off. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, the real challenge is when you turn the reactor off, you still have all this energy. And so if you were relying on the plant to generate the electricity for all those systems, well, when you turn the reactor off, you wouldn't have it. So you need that energy to come in or that power to come in from outside the plant. And there are basically two ways. You have your normal electricity lines and your, you know, typical high voltage transmission lines and all those kinds of things that supply power. And then if you lose those, all the plants have a backup power supply system. And typically those are diesel engines. They burn diesel fuel, and they're very large engines that can generate a lot of electricity. Well, those diesel engines were disabled by the tsunami. And of course, diesel engines rely on diesel to operate. So the tsunami wave took out the storage tanks, took out the fuel supplies. So now you couldn't operate these diesel engines. And so now your backup supplies of power were gone. But it is an interesting feature of the plants that they don't really use their own power in order to supply these safety systems. But it makes sense, I think, when you think about it, because then, of course, when the reactor shut down, you wouldn't have any source of electricity for them.
So you have this crisis because there is no energy to run the safety, fail-safe technologies that keep the heat from building up and deal with that appropriately. You say, though, from your perspective, the biggest challenge was a lack of reliable information. Can you talk about how and why communications broke down?
Yeah, so we were in our headquarters, our operations center in just north of Washington, D.C., in a little suburb of Washington, D.C., and we were trying to understand what was going on. And in the U.S., we would expect that nuclear power plants would be supplying us with information through some electronic communication systems we have. But here we were dealing with a reactor that was several reactors that were thousands of miles away in Japan. So number one, we're a little bit limited in how we can get information. But number two, when you lose all this power, you also lose all the instrumentation. Hmm. You also lose all the devices that are there to tell you what's going on with the reactor. So, you know, it really was a catastrophic failure of all the systems that exist to help you respond. So, you know, as I said, the control room operators, and I think people don't realize the heroic actions they really took, because they were operating in the dark, figuratively and literally, without lights on in their control room and without, you know, you can imagine, you know, like if you ever watch Star Trek, you know, some kind of panels with lots of lights and blinking and flashing things. You know, that's what a typical nuclear power plant control room looks like. And there's a lot of them. There's, you know, hundreds of these little cubes with lights on and different colors all over the place. They're all gone. Hmm. And these operators train and train and train to know how to respond to emergency based on what those lights tell them, what the audible alarms tell them. All of that was gone. So nobody really knew what was happening with the reactors. So you have to rely on kind of secondary indications. So radiation readings outside the plant, physically looking at what you're seeing. And, you know, obviously there were very significant things that happened within a day or so of the accident starting. people watched on TV, on live feeds of massive explosions happening at these reactors. Well, that was from an accumulation of hydrogen, and that was a clear indication that something was going very wrong.
Can you talk about what a hydrogen explosion looks like?
Yeah, so in a way, the most iconic imagery of a hydrogen explosion that I often think of and associate with it is the Hindenburg disaster. So the Hindenburg was an airship that that was created in the 1930s or 1940s, and it was filled with hydrogen. Well, one of these airships was coming over to the U.S. and docking in New Jersey, and for a variety of reasons that aren't fully understood, a spark ignited that hydrogen, and hydrogen will burn very, very easily, and it makes a big fireball. So that's kind of what I always thought about hydrogen. Well, I now have a new image, and that is the image, and I think many, many people watch this in real time, of a powerful explosion which lifted material from this nuclear reactor, actually three of the reactors at the Fukushima site in Japan, and lifted massive amounts of material up into the air in a massive explosion. That was the result of this hydrogen accumulating. And it comes from, again, this whole process of the heat not being able to be taken away from the reactor. And when that happens, you've got all this water that's around there, and that water starts to turn to steam. And that steam then interacts with the fuel that actually powers the reactor, and it produces hydrogen. And so if you don't control that hydrogen, you don't get rid of it, you don't release it, it can explode. And that's exactly what happened, and it happened several times at the reactor accident. And it was really one of the precipitating events that really took the reactors beyond the point of no return.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You say that each time there is a major accident, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, everybody seems to convince themselves, everybody in the nuclear energy industry, that this is the last time it will ever happen. That sounds like magical thinking to me.
Yeah, I think it's one of those realizations I came to, is that I needed to stop talking about accidents may happen or accidents might happen, but start talking about the fact that accidents will happen. We can no longer escape that reality. And I think if people start to talk about nuclear technology in that way, it's a much more honest conversation about the realities. And, there certainly are people who could say, well, that's fine. I'm willing to accept that because I don't think it's going to happen in my plant or in my community. And if it does, it'll happen, well after I'm living here or whatever the case may be. But that's a very different conversation than trying to act as if this thing just isn't going to happen. And we saw that with the accident in Japan, and I saw it perhaps more importantly when I was working to try and make changes to the reactors here in the U.S. And one of the things that I said around this accident in to reassure people in the U.S. was that we believed the plants were safe, but that we were going to take a look after the accident and figure that out for sure. And if we identified things that needed to be changed, then we would work to make those improvements. And one of the things I was most proud of while I was at the NRC was the work of a task force that we set up to look at this accident and come up with recommendations for how to fix plants in the United States. And they came up with 12 recommendations, which were really common sense recommendations that would have made meaningful improvements to the safety of plants in the United States. And those recommendations were fought almost from the beginning by my colleagues on the commission, by the industry. And in fact, to this day, many of those recommendations have never been implemented. So, I think there are still many people in the nuclear industry here in the U.S. who aren't willing to accept the fact that an accident will happen here. It's just a question of when. And nobody can really predict that with certainty.
Do you think the nuclear energy industry is in denial, or do you think it is willfully ignoring this information in service to profits and remaining in business?
I think when you really talk to people in the industry, they will acknowledge these facts. They will say, yeah, we know we can never say there's not going to be accidents, but they won't come out publicly and say it. And it does have a negative impact. I think, it certainly would have an impact on the public perception of their technology, which they like to tout as very technically sophisticated and therefore, very advanced and safe. And so, they don't want to talk about this honestly, and I think that's a mistake. But at the end of the day, it comes down to money. And right now, nuclear power plants in many parts of the country are struggling because they are expensive. And in many cases, they're more expensive than other forms of electricity, and especially other forms of electricity that don't generate carbon emissions, like wind and solar. So they're facing a lot of competition economically, and so they don't want to talk about these issues because people may begin to realize that, well, you know, maybe there are better ways to get the same kinds of things that we can get from nuclear power without all these concerns, without the risk of accidents, without the expense, without the fuel storage issues, which we haven't really even talked about.
Yeah, of course, this is this nuclear power does not put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but it creates waste that will be around for tens of thousands of years, long after, as you point out, all these companies producing the waste have gone out of business.
Yeah, in fact, the waste is really hazardous for hundreds of thousands of years, which is almost unthinkable to deal with. As a safety regulator, this was an issue I was confronted with. How are you supposed to design a system that ensures the safety of something that will most likely outlast the organization that created those rules to begin with? It's just not really something that you can do. And so, there's just this philosophical challenge with trying to do it. And then there's just the physical realities. Where do you put it and how can you secure it over this long period of time? And all of these issues are certainly important right now, but they become even more significant when people start to talk about nuclear power as a savior for climate change. And that's really the main talking point, in a way, for nuclear power right now, is that we're never going to deal with climate change without it. And I actually think that's completely wrong. I think the opposite is true, is that if we rely on nuclear, we're never going to solve climate change.
My guest is Gregory B. Yatsko. He's former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and has a book out called Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chairman Gregory B. Yatsko. His new book is called Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Greg, to what extent is nuclear waste effectively the government's responsibility rather than the responsibility of the companies that earn their profits generating it?
There's a really long history about nuclear waste, and the early part of the industry, the companies that were generating electricity and, of course, generating profits off of that, the sale of that electricity, were producing this waste, and they had to start to figure out what to do with it. And it quickly became clear that on their own, they weren't going to solve that problem. And so really to protect the industry, and because if there wasn't a solution for the waste, you really couldn't keep generating electricity from nuclear, the federal government stepped in and decided that the federal government would be responsible for the waste. And it's a very unique element of almost any industry in the country that the federal government would step in and say, we'll take care of your waste problem and we'll be responsible for it. So I don't know another industry where they have that kind of deal. And for the power companies, it's a great deal because, this issue, which is a multi-generational problem, 100,000 years or more, is now the responsibility of the federal government. And the federal government has struggled to figure out a response.
So for the time being, a lot of that waste is being stored on site at the places where it's generated?
Yeah, right now the waste is stored on site and it's maintained there. The federal government was supposed to find a repository, and because of a lot of bad politics and bad political decision-making, they tried to find a place in Nevada, and people in Nevada fought that because they felt like the choice of Nevada was a political decision, which it was. And so they fought it for a long time, and eventually, while I was chairman, then President Obama, pulled the plug on the project. And so now you have this waste, which is still being produced, which I find really one of the interesting parts of the whole issue is that we have not yet stopped producing it, even though we don't really have a solution for what to do with it for this really, really long period of time. So it stays at the reactor sites where it's produced. And in some cases, it's in what are called spent fuel pools, which are pretty much what they sound like. They're really big, giant, almost like diving tanks, where you keep the fuel so it cools off. and is protected. The radiation is then protect or people are protected from the radiation. Some places they've taken that fuel out of these pools and they put it in concrete bunkers and silos, again, to keep it protected until a longer term solution is identified.
So I understand, at least to the extent I think I need to, that the sort of radioactive toxicity of nuclear waste. I'm not clear on volume. Like a nuclear power plant of significant size somewhere, what is the mass of the waste it's generating in a given year? Like a bucket, like a barrel, yes. Like a football field.
Yeah, so this is one of the, you know, one of the advantages of nuclear power is it's a very, very concentrated form of fuel. So I think the statistic that you'll hear a lot is that all of the nuclear waste right now that's produced is, fits on, say a football size field if you kind of compressed it all together and stacked it a few layers high. So, it's not a huge volume of material, but it is highly dangerous because of the radiation component. So it needs to be isolated from the environment. It needs to be isolated from people in order to ensure that they don't get an unreasonable exposure to radiation or the environment doesn't get contaminated from this radiation. So it's one of the advantages of nuclear power is you have this really high density of energy. But of course, with that comes all of this extra energy you need to deal with and process. And so, it's one of the good and bad features of the waste.
Do you have any regrets about reassurances you gave the American people when you were chair of the NRC?
One of the things that I look back on and wish I had talked more about was this waste question, because it is the elephant in the room. And the reality is we don't have a permanent solution for the waste. And, as the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I probably should have talked about that more, and I should have talked about it with the obvious conclusion that we probably need to stop generating it if we don't know what we're going to do with it, that this is something we have to think about. But I was willing to push the envelope on a lot of things. That one was probably one that would have been even too far for me to even try and get away with. So, it's just the nature of the job is that people don't want that kind of candor from the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because, this job in many ways has always been viewed as partially protecting the industry and looking out for the industry's interests. And, but that is one thing that I really look back on and think, this was an obvious thing that I should have been talking about and really didn't.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Zach calling from Denton. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll be real quick. I've got three things. So first off, with nuclear energy, I'd like to everybody talks about nuclear waste and how bad it is, but nobody ever talks about the heat output from nuclear plants, such as using a water reservoir or dumping heat into the air. So if you could touch on that. Also, I'd like to talk about how all forms of energy have their pros and cons, such as renewable energy, how we mine lithium. We have lithium mines that, they destroy beautiful areas, to get that materials, as well as, the photovoltaic cells. You touch on that.
All right. Thank you, Neil. What about that, Greg?
Yeah, so the nuclear power plants, they are big industrial facilities. They have a lot of waste. We talk of the big high-profile waste is the so-called spent fuel or the nuclear waste. But all nuclear power plants do need a lot of water because we've talked about this energy and the heat, and they need a lot of water to get rid of that energy. So usually they have some body of water where they take water in and they discharge that water back out. And that water is usually hotter than than it was when it came in. And that is a kind of thermal pollution. And it does impact typically aquatic species in the bodies of water. And so there are limits on how hot that water can be when it goes back out. The other thing that nuclear power plants do is they do emit low levels of radioactive material, some in air emissions and some in that water that's going back out. So there are these other environmental and waste streams that go with a nuclear power plant beyond just the nuclear waste itself.
All right. Next on the phone, we have Neil in Arlington. Hi, Neil.
Hi. I had a question for Mr. Gretz. What does countries like France and Great Britain do, which are major nuclear producing nations, with their waste?
What do you know about how France and Britain deal with that?
Yeah, well, nobody has really solved the long-term issue with nuclear waste. In France, they have a process, something they called reprocessing, where essentially they take the waste that comes out of a nuclear reactor and they process it so that they can use some of the material back in reactors again. But they, you know, in the U.S., we have kind of what's called a once-through process. So you use the fuel once, and then it would go to disposal, essentially. In France, they kind of have a twice-through. So they can use the fuel twice, but then after they've used it once, they're back in the same place that we are here in the U.S., which is needing to find some kind of place where you can permanently isolate this material for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And the United Kingdom is in a similar situation. They do some of this reprocessing, but not as much as they do in France.
Why has the U.S., compared to a lot of industrialized countries, say in Europe, been relatively slow to utilize renewable energy sources like wind and solar and geothermal? We do have it, but they've come on board a lot more slowly than they have abroad.
Yeah, you know, some of this just has to do with cost. I mean, there are some parts of the U.S. where decisions about electricity generation are based on cost. And a lot of the renewables, you know, 10, 15 years ago just weren't cost competitive. We, in this country, we have an abundance of natural resources. We have gas, we have coal, we had uranium for nuclear reactors. So, yeah, we turned to a lot of these sources earlier on, and of course now we're finding out that those were mistakes, that these sources of energy or electricity have long-term impacts on the environment, whether it's, you know, nuclear waste from nuclear reactors or whether it's the air emissions and the carbon emissions from fossil fuels. So one of the amazing things, and the thing that really makes me hopeful about the future right now, is that wind and solar are becoming so cheap. And they're getting cheaper faster than anybody can really keep up with. And so in the parts of the country where you really let the market decide how we're going to generate electricity, these kinds of sources are now becoming prevalent and they're starting to take over. Texas, for instance, Texas now gets twice as much of its electricity in a year from renewable sources than it does from nuclear. And, you know, that's sometimes, I think, forgotten. So here you have a place, Texas has a lot of unique features with its electricity grid, but it's got a tremendous amount of wind resources. And wind is now the cheapest way you can generate electricity in this country. So these things are, you know, they're starting to really snowball it and really come online faster now than I think anybody really imagined, and at prices that nobody really could imagine even 5 years ago.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tell us a little bit about the influence of the Nuclear Energy Institute, which, based on its name, people might not fully understand what it is and what it does.
Yeah, so the Nuclear Energy Institute is the lobbying arm of the nuclear power industry, and it's a very powerful organization, both in influencing Congress, but also in a lot of ways, I think, more impactfully by working and in trying to influence the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So they have staff and personnel that are always engaging with staff and personnel at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to advise them of what they think the right approaches are to safety on proposed regulations the agency may be considering. They always have comments and they provide feedback and input. And so it's a very, very powerful and influential organization. And really, I think one that's almost unique in its singular ability to influence a regulator like they do the NRC.
Can you think of a strategy that would allow commissioners of the NRC to be more independent than they have been up until the present moment?
You know, ultimately, the commissioners, they're chosen by the president and they're confirmed by the Senate. So to really get a more independent commission, you have to really look to the elected officials. It's up to those elected officials to make this independence a priority. And I think it certainly, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, the priority of really a majority of people in Congress and the Senate that has to confirm these positions has been to try and preserve this industry. And, you know, it's an industry that really can't survive on its own without a lot of backing and support from Congress or from states. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, it's probably going to take an accident in this country for people to really, really review and revise how they go about making those selections of those commissioners. And, you know, that's not something anybody wants to see. And I hope that that's not, you know, what precipitates change. But hopefully people will look at what's going on right now and recognize that nuclear technology, it is expensive, and it's not going to be the solution to climate change. So, you know, let's look at phasing it out, and let's look at making sure we're doing the right things to allow, you know, battery stores, to allow storage and renewables to come onto the market in the way that I think they can with the right conditions.
If tomorrow we were to decommission every nuclear energy facility in the United States, what would that look like? When you talk about phasing it out, I mean, would we be able to function in the short term without all that energy we get from nuclear now?
You know, nuclear makes up about 20% of our electricity. So, you know, I think the knee-jerk reaction is to say, you know, we wouldn't be able to function at all. But if you look at Japan, in Japan, after the Fukushima accident, they shut down all of their reactors, which was 30% of their electricity. And they survived. And they were able to cope with it. Now, of course, in the short term, they had to basically burn more fossil fuels. So it was not good for their long-term strategies on climate. And again, I think it's exposed a weakness in their reliance on nuclear as a solution to climate change. But in the years since then, they've actually done a tremendous amount of work to get more renewables onto the grid, to do a lot with energy efficiency, which, you know, that's always the forgotten energy source. It's energy efficiency. And, you know, so I think if tomorrow we had to shut down all our reactors, there would be a period of difficulty. But I think over time we'd recover. And unfortunately, that is a very real possibility because, you know, an accident at one plant in the U.S. would really throw the entire industry into doubt and could potentially lead to that kind of a requirement that many, many plants, if not all of them, would have to be shut down for at least a short period of time.
Gregory B. Yatsko is former commissioner and chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. His book is called Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. Greg, thanks so much for making time to speak with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.